Welcome to Section 9. My name is Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. And in this week's episode, we're going to be discussing the CIS Ubuntu security recommendations and our future plans and projects. And one of the things that we wanted to do in Section 9 was to try to figure out how to implement the CIS security requirements, you know, doing our projects. You worked on this week. How did you start your project?
So this time I took a look at the CIS Ubuntu Linux 16.04 LTS benchmark. And originally, I thought this was a baseline of some kind. And that's not what it is at all. So you can get this document at the cissecurity.org website. And they have a lot of stuff in there. You kind of have to sign up for an account. It's all free. You have access to all of their information. There is some stuff you have to pay for. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this particular document is 296 pages of security recommendations. And I thought, okay, what do I do with this? This is a lot of information. How am I going to approach this? So as I began to look through this document, I realized something really quickly. You're not supposed to use all of them. You pick and choose which requirements you want to have or which recommendations you're going to implement for your particular Ubuntu system. So that's kind of what I did here, is I went through and picked out some things that I thought, okay, we can implement these on our systems. It's not going to be that difficult, and we're going to get the benefit of that extra security. Now, there are some interesting things about the way they have this set up. So you have level 1 and level 2 recommendations. We'll talk about those. And then there are also, there's a scoring system that you can use, which we're not going to use, because you have to pay for some software to get that to work properly. And for us, because we're so small, we don't have that many systems, I don't think we need a scoring system for that. If you're a larger organization and you have more servers, you want to be more secure, and you want to verify that a system is meeting certain requirements, that's a situation where I may say, okay, we need to use the scoring system. Let's go ahead and pay for the extra software.
Okay. Well, one of the things that you mentioned this level 1 and level 2. So let me kind of go through what's on level 1. The level 1 recommendations are to be practical and prudent. They provide a clear security benefit, and they do not inhibit the utility of the technology beyond acceptable means. What does that mean?
So what that means is that if you implement one of the level 1 security recommendations, you're not going to damage the system. Now, you have to understand that when you implement any of these, you may have to make slight modifications to make it fit in with what you're trying to accomplish. But when you implement level 1, again, you're not going to damage the system and cause it to go offline for some reason.
Okay. So then the document also talks about level 2. And it says that level 2 recommendations are intended for environments or use cases where security is paramount. It acts as defense and in-depth measure, and it may negatively inhibit the utility or performance of the technology. What does that mean to you?
So in this case, you have to be very careful about how you implement level 2 recommendations. This is something that could possibly damage the system and cause it to stop working the way you need it to. So for level 2 recommendations, I recommend that you test these before you implement them. And I actually recommend you test level 1 as well so that you understand what you're implementing. But it's relatively safe to do level 1. As long as you understand how to take level 1 back out of the system, you should be okay. Level 2 is more complicated than that. So you may not be able to take level 2 out. Once it's in, okay, how do you take it out? Well, it may be so complicated to get it in there in the first place that you can't take it out now.
Okay, well, let's do this. Talking about level 1 again, why don't you describe, like, give us an example of level 1 and how the document deals with it, you know, what option it tells you and what to do.
So one of the things that we use a lot, and a lot of Linux people have this, is SSH.
Right.
So you have to have an SSH server configured on your Ubuntu server so you can remotely access it and manage it, right? So I thought, okay, let's take a look at the SSH section of the documentation and let's see how this works. And one of the things that is true about all of the different services you may have on a Linux system, whether that's, you know, Apache for a web server or SSH for, you know, remote administration, there's a lot of things within that configuration file that you have to manage. And I don't understand all of the things that are in the SSH configuration file. So I go in there and I configure a few things because we've already done that for our servers, right?
So you leave the default and then configure a few things. And yeah, we have done that.
So for example, we went ahead and moved our server to a different port number than 22. And then we also took out the remote root login, which is actually part of the CIS recommendations. They recommend you don't have that. You turn that off. And that prevents the root user from logging into the system because everybody knows what the root account is. It's root.
Right.
So you've already got that part figured out. All you have to do is figure out what the password is, and then you're in.
And that was actually really good that we did that. And it was a suggestion of DigitalOcean. They were actually really on the ball for that. And shortly after we put our server in, people were trying to get in. I mean, we looked at the logs, and they were like bombarded with IP addresses, sequential ones, trying to get in, trying to log as an admin and what have you. But let's go back to your example. So you took a look at SSH, and what are some of the options that they had in there, and what did they have to say? What did the document have to say about the options?
So the interesting thing about this document, and one of the things that I think is going to be really good for us, is that if you don't understand something, like some of the options for SSH servers, the document here or the recommendations come with explanations. So if it's an option I don't understand, I read the description, I look at the steps they want you to take to improve security, and then we go ahead and do that. So here's an example, and this is one of them. Ensure SSH max auth tries is set to 4 or less. So the maximum tries you get for logging into SSH is going to be 4 or less. And they have a description here, which helps. And the description here is, the max auth tries parameter specifies the maximum number of authentication attempts permitted per connection. When the login failure count reaches half the number, error messages will be written to the syslog file detailing the login failure. So in this case, if the setting is 4, when you miss 2, that gets logged into the system and you see an error message in there.
So it's actually telling you that if you use this option to ensure SSH max auth tries is set to 4 or less, this is what it's actually doing. So it's explaining what the option is.
Right. And then we have the rationale or the reason for implementing this.
Okay.
Setting the max auth tries parameter to a low number will minimize the risk of successful brute force attacks to the SSH server. While the recommended setting is 4, set the number based on site policy. So they're recommending 4 or less, but then if you have a company-wide policy, use that instead. But try to keep in mind, they want you to have a low number.
Yeah, that's nice because you can look at your security needs and a section, for example, on a service like SSH and take a look. And if you don't know what certain option is, you have the what it does and why it does it. So to me, that's really valuable. That seems like a really good document.
Right. And there was more stuff in the document where they gave you some commands that you could run to search the document quickly and see if that option was enabled.
Well, that's kind of nice.
And if it's in there, what's the value of that? And do you need to change it?
So I think this is going to be really good because we'll have whatever our configuration is for our SSH server. And then we can look at what the options are and see if those are things that we need and then modify that configuration. So
right. So for example, you don't know a lot about Linux.
Right.
But you know how to go and move around in the directories. You know how to edit files. So for example, if I gave you the SSH recommendations, you could configure the file as recommended by CIS.
Do they have the configuration in the document?
So what they do here is they don't have the entire configuration, but they have all of the recommendations are there. So the actual command or the actual line that you're going to see in the document or the information that you have to put into the document, if it's not there, is all part of the document, of the CIS document. So everything that you would have to change or modify or type into this new document or the configuration for SSH is all part of the CIS Ubuntu recommendations.
Okay, so let me get this straight in my head. So we have... They won't have the default configuration that we have on SSH, but basically, if you're trying to implement the option of the example that you're saying, they will have the command there for you to be able to do that?
Correct. So, for example,
I'm just trying to understand it.
Yeah. So, for example, the command might be something like max auth tries.
Got it.
And then they will have the exact, you know, stuff that you're going to type in there letter by letter for that option. So you can see that. And then if your configuration doesn't have it,
right,
this is what you type.
So these are just additional things that you would put in there. It's not your default configuration.
Well, it may be that they have the option in there and it may be configured right, but you need to double check and verify that that's the case.
Right.
So some of them you may not have to change. Others, the option may be there, but it's configured wrong.
Right.
So for example, the root login thing is there, but it's usually set to something you don't want.
Right.
So you have to go back in there and change it and set that to no, and then you're complying with the CIS recommendations. Now, one thing I should mention here is that, again, we have moved our SSH server to a different port number. That's not part of the CIS documentation. I would recommend that people do that. And then a lot of people are going to recommend that you use SSH keys, which is also not part of the CIS documentation. I didn't see that in there.
I wonder why they don't have that. But maybe there is another CIS document that may address it. You never know.
I don't know, but it's not part of this documentation. I didn't see that in there.
Right.
So in our case, this is what I would recommend for our Section 9 servers. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend using this for our internal servers, but for the ones that we have on DigitalOcean, right, I would recommend that we go back in there and follow all of the SSH recommendations, make sure that we have it on a different port number, that's an additional thing, and then also eventually use the SSH keys, because that's going to make us more secure.
Yeah, and we were thinking about setting those up anyway before this. So.
Right.
Okay, so that's example of level one. One of the things I was looking at, level two, that may negatively inhibit the utility or performance of the technology. Can you give us an example of what a level two recommendation would be like? And why it's so critical, or why it's so scary, or so, you know.
So
why would it have to mess up your system?
Right. So one of the things they have is a setup section. Mm-hmm. And part of the setup section is, okay, you're installing Ubuntu onto a new system. What kinds of partitions are you going to have on that system? So for me, normally what I do is I'll have a root partition for the operating system, and then I'll have a home partition. And I do that because I want to have user data in the home partition separate from everything else. So if I have to reinstall my Linux operating system, I can do that and keep my data inside of the home partition untouched.
Okay, that makes sense.
So once I get the system back up and running, my data is right there. I don't have to go do anything with it. Now, when I first started using Linux, there was this whole bunch of stuff and recommendations about how you should partition your system. And they had, you know, var should be a partition, temp should be a partition. There should be all these different partitions on the system. And I was like, well, how come you have to do that? And there was no real reason why you're supposed to do that. I never got a satisfactory answer. So then I just said, okay, well, from now on, I'm going to have the root and home, and I'm going to call it good.
Right.
To be more secure, the CIS recommendation is to have a bunch of partitions. And there's a reason for that. So you might have a partition for temp, and then one for var. There's also var temp, and there's reasons for this. So for example, temp is a world readable or writable partition or directory. So anybody, any user on the system can write data to temp, including executable files. So for example, you could put a script in there, you can have an application go in there, and then you can run that application. So if a hacker were to break into the system, they can write stuff to temp and write even their tools can go into temp. So whatever hacker tools they may have, they can run that from temp. So what the CIS recommendation is you create a partition for temp, and then you set it up so that when that partition is mounted, you have the no execute option on there. So if a hacker breaks in, tries to write a file to temp, they can do that because it's world writable. They won't be able to execute a binary application or a script of some kind because we have that no execute option applied to that partition. And there's no real way for them to change that.
Okay, well, but if they can, I guess for me, if they can go in there and write a file, an executable file, why can't they just change the no execute option?
So the no execute option is a special thing, and you haven't seen this yet, but one day we'll go ahead and take a look at how these things get mounted, especially since we're trying to do what is that, Linux from scratch at some point?
Right, right.
You'll see all of that in there. So what happens is when you mount something, usually that happens when the system boots.
Okay.
And there's a file in the system that specifies what the options are that are going to be applied to specific partitions or mount points. So in this case, we want to have the no execute as part of the option for mounting temp.
Temp, okay.
And so to try to change that while the system's running, that's pretty difficult to do. And if they do have the ability to do that...
Well, if they're that good, they're in your network.
They're already they own the system already, so
right.
They wouldn't even need that.
So most of these people that are trying to scan your network and trying to get in an easy, fast way, they're going to be discouraged by this. And that's where the security...
Well,
you know,
this is a little bit different. So this would be a security that you would do for preventing somebody to do further damage. So maybe they already have access to the system, but now they're trying to get their tools on there. So this is going to slow them down so you can catch them later on. So it's going to make it more difficult for them to get their tools onto the system.
Right. And I think that's where they talk about the defense in depth.
Correct. It's defense in depth.
Okay.
So for example, the SSH piece is going to make it more difficult for somebody to try to break in through SSH.
Right.
But let's say, for example, we didn't do that, or they find a way to get in through SSH. Now they have a user account on the system. Well, how do they get other tools in there? Well, let's write it to temp, and then we'll just execute the file there because I can do whatever I want in temp. Right. Well, if temp is set up where there's the no execute bit or the no execute option, they can dump their tools there, but they can't run them.
Right. That's
so that's kind of how you have to think of it. It's defense in depth or layered security, right? They broke in through SSH, but now they can't run their tools because we have this other layer of security in place to prevent them from doing that.
That's good. But when we were talking about the partitions, you had a little worry. Do you want to tell us about the little worry?
So here's the situation. Let's say, for example, you have a terabyte drive you want to, you know, set up on the... Well, let me take a step back. VAR is a place where we store all of our log files.
Right.
So let's say, for example, I set up VAR as a separate partition. And VAR is kind of small. And we have all of our log files going there. And let's say this is a busy system, lots of logs. And one day I noticed that VAR is getting to be too small. We're running out of space. Well, what do I do? In the old days, you couldn't do anything about that. You'd have to rebuild your system because there was no way for you to change any of that. Now, in a production environment for a large company, you're going to have teams of people who are going to tell you, this is how big we want you to make VAR. This is why. For us, it's a little tricky to figure out what that is. Even for larger companies, it's a bit tricky to figure out what that is because you don't really know how much data you're going to be putting in there in terms of logs. So what they came up with eventually is this thing called Logical Volume Manager. What this does is it allows you to resize a partition while the system's actually running.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of cool. It's a little dangerous. You have to be a bit careful about how you do this, but you can do it. So let's say, for example, we have a terabyte drive for our Linux system.
Okay.
I do my installation, and as I'm partitioning all these partitions out, so let's say we do var, temp, var, temp, and a bunch of other ones, I take up 500 gigabytes of the drive. So I'm using half a terabyte. We still have 500 gigabytes of free space. So I can use Logical Volume Manager in that situation to make the VAR partition bigger. So let's say, for example, we run out of space. I need it to be bigger. I can use LVM and say, okay, we have 500 gigabytes of free space that's not allocated to anything. I'm going to use 100 gigs. I'm going to take that, apply it to VAR. Now VAR has an extra 100 gigs of space to store our log files or whatever else goes into VAR. So that's kind of how that works. But look at how much work went into that. You have to think about your partition sizes. You have to think about how you're going to manage all of that. You have to think about the skill necessary to do things like resize the partition. There's risk in resizing the partition. You have to understand how logical volume management works. There's a lot of steps involved in using that tool. So for us, in our situation, should we be doing that? I don't think so. I don't think we need that level of security. And when we look at our DigitalOcean servers, which are the only ones that are on the internet and have potential issues with hackers getting in and breaking into the system and doing something, I don't think that's really a big issue. If we make sure that our SSH is secure, we should be okay. as far as running out of space, we can actually resize our DigitalOcean servers. We go in there, the web interface, you click a button and you say, make it bigger.
Right. And they're probably doing this in the background.
So something along those lines in the background is going to be a bigger system.
Well, and if you're in an enterprise environment and you need to be implementing one of these level two things, your network engineer better know what he's doing.
Well, your Linux people are going to be doing
that. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You're going to have somebody there who knows what they're doing. There's just two of us here. We don't have the time or the resources to be able to do that.
But, you know, it's a good thing that, you know, taking a look at these documents and seeing the things that are available, you know, to you and everyone else. I mean, these documents are out there, how to implement them. I was really impressed with, here is the option. Here is what the option does with a description. And this is why that option does it. And then you can decide, okay, this fits my network or not. And this is implementable or not. Okay. Did you take a look at anything else?
So the second thing here that we want to take a look at is the firewall options. So far we're going to do the SSH stuff.
Okay.
We're skipping the partitions because that's too hard. Now we're taking a look at something that I think is a really quick win for us, is the firewall option. So this is a level one recommendation. So we can implement this and we're not going to have any issues. So for the firewall options, I thought this was really cool because we're talking about IP tables here, and IP tables is installed on most Linux distributions. We also have the UFW firewall, and the UFW firewall is the uncomplicated firewall, and this comes with Ubuntu. I'm not sure if you can get it with other Linux distributions, but it is on Ubuntu, and this is a front end to IP tables, so it helps you configure IP tables. It's a little easier to use than IP tables, and if you look at the documentation on this CIS document, they say that IP tables is more flexible. You can do more things with it. For us, we're doing basic things, so we don't necessarily need complicated or fancy. So for us, we can actually just use the UFW firewall and we'll be fine. Now, one of the things that I found interesting about this is that they want something basic. So ultimately, what you're doing here is a default deny policy to prevent traffic outside your system from coming into the system. You're blocking all of that by default. Now, if you need something to come in, like let's say we're doing a web server, I need something to come into port 80, you're going to have to allow for that. Now, the cool thing about this is that this particular CIS document has an IP tables firewall script in there. So you can actually copy and paste that into your system and it will work just fine.
Oh, nice.
Now, you have to understand how to get that to work properly, but all of the commands and everything for the actual firewall script for IP tables is there.
So the recommendation is the default deny policy?
Right. And basically, you're just saying, okay, if we're not allowing it in, just deny it.
Okay. So then you look at your security requirements, and if you need SSH or anything else, then you will be modifying that to at least allow that, correct?
Correct. Okay. Now, with the UFW firewall, it gets a little tricky. The CIS recommendation allows for you to use UFW because they say the default configuration is fine. You can use that, and it will meet the requirements that they have for implementing a firewall solution. Now, when you do this, so here are some commands. If you're using IP tables, you want to type in IP tables dash capital L. And this will tell you whether or not you have any rules applied with your IP tables firewall. And then if you want to have more information, you can do IP tables dash capital L dash N dash V, and you'll get more information out of that. Now let's move on to the UFW firewall. If you want to see if it's enabled, you can type in UFW status, and it will say enabled or inactive or active or something like that. By default, both of these are not enabled at all.
I know, we found that out the hard way because we had UFW.
Correct.
We had that configured and we were trying to test some stuff, and all of a sudden it's like, what's going on? And we did not know that by default they were not enabled IP tables as well as that. So we really needed to make sure that we did that. But it showed up the minute we did the UFW status. So
right. So now what you have to do is, in order to turn on UFW, you have to say UFW enable and then you've turned it on.
Got it.
Now, the thing that I find goofy is that when you use UFW, there's a UFW configuration file that's not part of IP tables. So when you do UFW status on a default configuration, all it's going to tell you is that it's active. It's not going to show you any rules. Hmm. So you have to type in iptables-L.
To see the list of the rules?
Right, right.
Oh, wow.
So there is some IP table stuff going on behind the scenes with the UFW firewall.
Got it.
So again, it's a front end to IP tables. But the cool thing about all of this is that they give you the necessary information you need to set this up. And then for us, because we're not trying to be fancy or anything like that, we can use the UFW firewall, and I think we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, you know, when you told me that document was 296 pages, I was like, too overwhelming. I wouldn't know what to do with it. But actually, it's a good thing that you looked into it. And for me now, it's going to be easy to use it because, you know, there is the option, the description, and again, the reason why. One of the really cool things you mentioned was AID.
Yeah, so AID is the Advanced Intrusion Detection Environment. So what this thing does...
It's level one?
Yeah, it's level one. It's a level one option. So what this thing does is it... You configure it to monitor your system. And what you're really trying to do here is monitor specific files. So for example, one important file would be the password file because that's where user account information is stored. And this used to be done by something called Tripwire. Tripwire was a program that did the exact same thing, but it went commercial... And now you have to pay for that. So somebody said, hey, you know what?
So it was free before?
Tripwire used to be free. That's the one that I've used Tripwire before.
Okay.
But then when it went commercial, you had to pay for it. So somebody decided to create AID because they didn't want to have to pay for Tripwire. And AID does the exact same thing. So let's say, for example, I configure AID to monitor the password file. And we go back to the SANS cheat sheet for checking.
When we were trying to test security to where they sat in there and they're like, okay, you need to go in and see if anybody had added any users to the network or did they put any software or any kind of an application or something that it wasn't there before. And we had to look at the logs, right?
Right. So you would go in and you would check the password file to see if any users had been added to your Ubuntu server. Now, this particular setup, if I put AID in there, this is kind of how it works. You're going to have to get a baseline. And what it does is it says, okay, which files am I looking for? And then it creates a hash of the file. So for example, our password file, we create a hash. And it's a long string of letters and numbers that gets stored in a database. And then once a day, you run AID. And AID checks to see if that hash is different. If somebody breaks into the system and tries to create a user account, the password file is going to be changed, and then when the AID software or program is run, the hash doesn't match, we get an alert, and we know that that file's been changed.
Oh, nice.
So instead of having to manually check all these things, it's automated. And what happens when you have manual stuff? You forget.
Right.
And then you don't do it.
Okay.
So by having that in there, we increase our security because now we will detect a hacker who's in there trying to do things they're not supposed to do.
But if you do want to do it manually, SANS has some free cheat sheets that you can look at, and it has commands for that kind of thing.
Yeah, and this is not going to replace all of that, but it will replace some of it.
No, I understand. Okay, how about our future plans and projects? What do you have in mind for us?
So, you know, I'm going to be going through more of these CIS documents and recommendations to try to figure out, you know, how can we secure more of the Linux server? Or our workstations.
Because hey, I get dibs in the Google one.
Yeah, so there's more options on this Linux document here that we may want to use. So I have to go through that as well, figure out more about AID because I haven't implemented that yet. And then we have other ones, like there's one for Windows. So like you said, there's one for the Chrome web browser. So there's a lot of stuff that we need to look at and figure out, okay, what applies to us? What is going to be our baseline? Because the document is there as a recommendation. Now what we need to do is pick... you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 things out of there and say, okay, this is our baseline for Ubuntu servers. This is our baseline for Windows 10 workstation. This is our baseline for Server 2012 or 2016, right? Mm. So eventually we're going to get there. So for future stuff, I've been looking at some books that you purchased for us. So we have the basic security testing with Kali Linux. That's one I'm looking at. And so it goes through a lot of the tools that are in Kali Linux because one of the things I'm thinking about doing is the SANS master's degree. Now, before I do that, I want to make sure I understand at least some of the basics for Kali Linux and all the tools they have in there, because I can use that in class, and well, I can also use that for practice.
I mean, if you actually learn how to use the tools, then when you go to SANS and you're focusing on your master's degree, you're not going to have to stop and go, okay, let me learn this tool to be able to do whatever it is they're asking you to do. And, you know, it's a good idea for you to look at all those tools.
Yeah, because a lot of the tools that are in Kali Linux are the very tools you're using when you go to SANS.
Correct.
So, and then another book that you got for us is the Hacker Playbook 2. And this, I haven't really looked at this yet, but this is about pen testing. And it covers, you know, some of the things you're going to do if you're pen testing. So that's one of the things I want to look at as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then just for general IT knowledge, I want to go through and take the ITIL certification. And that's going to give us best practices. So they talk about change management, virtual machines. What else is in there? There's a bunch of stuff in there. And it's basically going to help you figure out how to manage IT and give you best practices. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that it's better to find out what the best practices are. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. Same with security. Why do we have the CIS recommendations? Why are we looking at these? I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And not only that, I don't have the necessary skills to be able to come up with my own recommendations.
Well, and not only that, I think in ITIL as well as the CIS recommendations and everything, those documents are out there. Best practices, and you know, somebody actually that knew what they're doing sat down and did that. So if you learn to implement them, then you don't have to worry about doing the thinking. What you have to figure out is what fits your network, what fits your security needs, and use something that is solid security. So, you know, I think they're pretty useful and they're free and they're out there.
So what are some of the things that you're working on?
Right now I'm working on a complicated lab. Usually, you know, I don't get to kind of explain what the lab is until I get it all done and over with. But, you know, we're looking at configuring the firewall for certain things, doing more than one floor for the network. So the network's getting a little more complicated and, you know, we're just moving different things. Because basically what you're wanting me to do is if I just get the networking part done, when it comes to us getting heavy duty into security, you know, you want to say to me, okay, set up a network with this many hosts and this many devices because I want to test the security tool and do this, that, and the other. So, you know, you're not going to have to worry about that and I would be able to do it. So right now I'm learning my networking and once that I get this last project done, I think I'll be closer to be able to kind of say, hey, you know, let's share this big old network map and what we did. And
right. And it is complicated because we want an enterprise level network, not super huge or anything like that.
Yeah.
Something more along the medium size. And you want to be able to say, hey, this is a network you can use over, let's say, 3 or 4 floors. Here's the firewall piece. Here's the switching piece. Here's the routing piece. And here are all the network addresses we're going to be using for this.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm really enjoying the core switch that I had to put in there and the spanning tree part of it. And all of that is really interesting. I never thought that I really would be able to understand what spanning tree. I can tell you what it was for, but actually seeing it in action and seeing what it does, it's been really interesting. I'm really enjoying it. So,
is there anything else?
No, I don't have anything else. It's all about US security this week.
So if you want to see our show notes, you can see them at section9.us. If you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.